Hello, everyone. Welcome to CryptChat, your weekly podcast on everything disability. Returning with us is the amazing Samantha Connor. How are you? How are you, Samantha?
I am tired, but good, Ibby. How are you?
Yeah, all good. Thank you for joining us once again. And how are you, Jonathan?
I am good. It's a week. I need to see him back on.
It's been ages, Jonathan.
It's always exciting to have on. Welcome. So, let's get into it. So, Samantha, we are talking about the NDIS. So, tell us a bit about yourself and some key insights from the NDIS that must have resonated with you.
Oh, gosh. The bit about myself is quite boring. I live in New South Wales now, just come back from WA. Nothing's changed there. Got a little bit quieter. And I used to be the president of People with Disability Australia, then the vice president, and now off the board. I'm doing tiny bits of work for almost everybody in the world right now, which is really good because you get a handle on lots of different things. And key insights from the NDIS review. Oh, gosh. I think there's a few things that made us all go, oh, shit, we need to maybe have a look at these a bit harder. I've sworn already and it's only 2 minutes into it. Gosh. Anyway, you guys are from West Sydney. You're fine.
Yeah, good stuff.
I'm from the wheat belt. So biggest thing for me are, you know, the potential for two different classes of citizens, you know, people who potentially are going to get kicked out of the NDIS or not allowed onto the NDIS because they're not considered to be disabled enough. I don't think the NDIS has a good handle on who's disabled and who's not. One in three supports for me means segregation and congregate settings, like group settings and group homes. I think that's shit. I might as well swear again. And the other thing I think a lot of people are talking about registration of providers and a return to block funding. I think there's other things in there that we need to look really closely at, and they are things like who's going to be setting the pricing and also that they're harmonising it with the aged care sector and the Aged Care Act right now. And I think they're things that we need to be aware of at the moment.
Yeah, we do. We watch space. Can you share your experience with the 1-3 shared supports model? And how has it impacted participants and your daily life?
So for me, I'm one of those really lucky people because articulate, not considered disabled enough. I'm one of those people who is unlikely would be thrown into a group home, right? It's people who have a really high support needs, people who have communication differences and high personal care and behavioural needs, especially people who need 24-hour support, that are most likely to be in a 1-3 shared support model. So, I mean, they've been saying, look, we're not saying that everyone should be chucked into a group home. That's not what we mean. But we want to know how it's going to work practically, right? So, and we also want to know how we're going to stop the NDIA, who already want to chuck people in group homes, in my experience. You shouldn't have to justify living in a house on a street. So Article 19 of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of People with Disability says really clearly, we get to live where we want to live and who we want to live with, and we get to make those choices. And when you get real choice, it means that you get a shot at another type of thing. You know, it doesn't mean that someone gives you Weet-Bix and then cornflakes and says, make a choice between those things. You should be able to go out to a shop and go, right, I want to go online shopping. I want to get Fruit Loops. I want to have, Cocoa Pops. I want to have warm milk in my Weet-Bix and I don't want to have it at 6 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, so choices should be about real choice and control.
Yeah, and there's also the issue of privacy. I just want to flag, you know, when you have those group homes, and how much privacy is there for the individual?
Look, I think it just depends. I think, you know, I've been in WA. I was actually looking after someone's cats at my friend's SDA apartment, and it was really nice. Like, it was a summer foundation old apartments that they've sold off to some other people. That person, their SIL supports aren't connected to their SDA supports. So, you know, they're able to have cats, they're able to do what they like, they've got self-management, you know, really able to look after their own funding and their own people. But then another friend that I know, also from WA, moved into a place and, you know, ended up with 4 hours a week of SIL and has probably the same level of support needs and ended up really sick and in hospital. And the times that we've visited there's been that real institutional culture. Like, there's laminated pictures of everybody, all the residents, with all the cheesy pictures up around the, you know, the walls and whatever, to try and make it more home-like. But it's not really like a home, it's like an institution, you know. And that person ended up, you know, with really big psychological issues, like some physical issues, ended up being in hospital for nearly 6 months. And that's cost the government huge amounts of money, because it costs a lot of money for someone to go to hospital for 6 months, right? So I think there's some false economies in the way that they've been doing this. Like, people need the support, not just somewhere to live. They need individualized support in the way that the NDIS was supposed to work.
Building on, you know, group homes, what are your thoughts on congregate living or group homes as opposed to independent living in the community under the NDIS?
Oh, there's a really good paper that Disabled Persons Organisations Australia wrote. If you just Google segregation DPOA, and it will come up with this report that they did. And it talks about Article 19 in a way that people can understand, you know, that we have the right to live in the same way that other people do. And a long time ago, people pointed out, you know, you can be just as lonely in an ordinary house on an ordinary street, you know, which you can, right? But, you know, at the same time, you can be just as lonely on an ordinary house on an ordinary street, but you can also be unsupported in a place that's full of everyone. So you need to get that balance right with, you know, who you're with. If you're choosing to live with someone, usually that would be your family, you know, like your husband or wife or partner or brother, or if you're at uni, then a share house. Like, if you look at what other non-disabled people do, we should have the same right to do those things as other people do. If we're not particularly well off and we're in a housing crisis, which we are now, we might choose to have someone to come and live with us, right? But it should be someone that we choose into our home. So it's a tricky thing right now. I think the thing is about choice, and quite often the choices that are offered to us aren't real choices. They're, yeah, Weet-Bix or cornflakes.
Yeah. Hey, thank you for sharing, Kuswanta. Have you encountered any challenges or benefits in choosing between registered and unregistered NDIS service providers?
Yeah, I have. I used to be a scout leader, and so for me, I used to do the Anzac Vigil every year, where you get a group of 10-year-old kids and you'd have to stand around the, you know, the, what do they call it? The big piece of stone in the, you know, the memorial, and you'd have to stand there.
That statue.
Yeah, that's the thing. You'd have to stand there all night with kids. And so it would be a really long, long night. And in the place that I was living, it was up a massive hill. And so, you know, I had to get there, help the kids set up their tents, and then navigate tired kids up and down, you know, and look after them and be able to get them up and down this hill and supervise them and look after the ones back there. And that was never going to happen by myself. So I'd always hire disabled people. That's my rule. You know, I only hire disabled people. And I would hire a disabled scout leader. And the scout leader would turn up in scout uniform. They'd know what to do. They'd know what the kids were supposed to be doing. They'd know how to tie a knot, set up a tent. They'd know how to, you know, salute the flag, deal with the kids. They all had the right checks, you know, working with children's cards and that kind of thing. And so it was a real benefit for me that I had people who were already skilled to do what I needed them to do. And so, of course, that wasn't a registered provider, and nor did it come from a registered provider. Most people with disability aren't employed by service providers. So for me, having somebody, you know, I've had a young man supporting me who has Down syndrome and doesn't use spoken language, and, you know, was bloody fantastic support worker, laughed at my bad jokes and shares my bad taste in music. and 80s music. So, and, you know, could do the job that I needed him to do. The big difference, I think, is making sure that we have choices. You know, I understand for a lot of people, they want to make sure that they train their support workers. Also, there's parents who have concerns about making sure that you have safe support workers. Really, there's no guarantee with having a registered provider of services. Anne-Marie Smith, if you remember her, died under a registered provider. And when we FOI'd this, it said that more registered providers have had both complaints and upheld complaints against them than unregistered providers. So it doesn't make us any safer if they've got 12 grand a year to pay for an audit and can fill out all the forms, you know. It just makes them a bit richer and a bit better at paying the government, really.
Yeah. I love the 80s music myself.
Do you guys use agencies like as your own personal supports, or do you not?
I do. I don't use agencies. I kind of self-manage. So, yeah. I choose whoever I want to employ to support me, which I guess it gives me the flexibility. Sorry, John, go ahead.
Yeah, cool. What about you, Jonathan?
I self-manage by using support provider.
Yeah, cool. I think there's a bit of a division with, you know, the idea of what makes things safer. And I think this has been a very strong push by the unions to say that they want, you know, they want registered providers, all the providers to be registered. And also to have panel providers for things like equipment and therapy and early intervention and behaviour support. We've heard that that's being flagged as something that's on the radar. So I don't really want to go and have a choice of, you know, whether I'm going to get a quickie or a Karma in the manual wheelchair choices. I have a Bartek hand bike electric thing, so I can fold it up, put it in a taxi, some weird thing from Spain. But it means that I haven't had to pay for a $75,000 taxi, a wheelchair van, and neither is anybody else. And it also means that I'm able to be more independent, so I don't have to hire a support worker to push me around.
No, I agree. Just the cost is a burden. But I'd say that, moving on to the next question, how does the registration status of a provider influence your sense of choice and control?
I think it's a bit like the training for support workers. You know, I always hear from people that they say they've done a cert, if a worker says they've done a cert 3 or a cert 4 of disability at a TAFE, then they won't hire them or they have to untrain them. And like, I think there's good people who have done that qualification, but I think there's dodgy people. Like, I can go on Gumtree right now and buy a provider. You can just buy one from Gumtree. So there's, and you can also hire people who will get you through the registration process. So it's not a guarantee of being a good provider with good workers, having a good work ethic, understanding disability rights, being a rapist or not. Like, they're not things that actually are related to your registration process. It just means you got 12 or 15 grand and you can pay someone and you can get paperwork through the process and undertake an audit every so often. So it doesn't really, I'd prefer to have workers who are people, preferably disabled people, for equipment. All of the wheelchairs I've ever bought have always been through disabled people, you know, in both here and in Western Australia and in Victoria as well. They've all been people who have, disabled people who have started up their own businesses. And I'd hate to see those small businesses who really understand, you know, what other people like them need go under, because we're going to have, you know, the big ability centres in Rocky Bays in Western Australia, or whoever the equivalent is, you know, the Endeavour Foundation in Queensland. I don't know who the big players are in New South Wales now.
I don't know.
Let's go with Northcott. Throw Northcott under the bus. But, you know, they're the people who would be likely to get a big contract to provide wheelchairs, right? Like, you know, those big providers. So I think it should be up to, It should be the same as buying a car, that you could buy a car from Facebook Marketplace. You could buy a car from a car yard. You can buy a car from your brother-in-law. Some states like WA don't even have a roadworthy to do. Did you know?
Oh, wow. Really?
I only found out that you weren't cowboys like us when I moved to New South Wales.
Oh, that's interesting. Good to know.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. Can you speak about your experiences in navigating tourist control, particularly concerning aids and equipment?
Yeah, so choice and control for me is about making sure that, you know, you've got equipment that suits you. Back in, I have a degenerative disability. I have limb-girdle muscular dystrophy. So I started off with crutches and then moved to a manual wheelchair and then moved to power wheels and then I moved to a smart drive. I nearly killed myself with the smart drive several thousand times.
Yeah, don't get me started.
I have ADHD as well, and there's a motion-activated watch. And so you tap the watch and it makes the smart drive go. And once it goes, like, it doesn't stop until you tap it again. One day I was on the stage at the Sydney Opera House doing a talk with some other disabled people. They were clapping different people on the panel, and so they introduced Catherine and Nia, and I clapped. And then it set my smart drive off and I went straight over to the edge of the bloody stage. And one of my friends, fortunately, knew how they worked and managed to grab it and stop me.
No way, no.
So that was a bad match for me. So then I just went back to using a chair until I couldn't anymore, just a manual chair with support workers. And then I couldn't do that anymore because I'm too fat and old and muscular dystrophy to push myself. So I got a hand bike, and that thing's been, I've done 600 and something kilometres in it.
Wow.
And I've had it a year.
Yeah.
So, you know, in terms of independence, if you work out how long it takes somebody to do 600 kilometres at over the speed limit, then that's how much I've saved in support workers.
Interesting.
So, yeah, that was the right fit for me and hopefully for a while yet.
Now, thank you for sharing, Amanda. How has NDIS supported or hindered your ability to make choices regarding the aids and equipment that you need?
I think not so much. I mean, NDIS has been really supportive of me getting the equipment that I needed, you know, so I had a good OT. When I had the smart drive scripted, it wasn't the NDIS who wanted me to do training. The provider in WA wanted me to do training. I was like, well, I've already had a smart drive. Like, what do you want me to do? Like, I've had one for 5 years. They said, oh, no, you need to be trained and you need to pay us for a day of training. And I was like, no, that's just bullshit. And so I ended up going and staying with another disabled person who had a husband who used a smart drive, and he just, you know, I just took his smart drive out for a day and he wrote a thing saying that he'd been a peer supporter. And they signed it off. That was a bit of a hindrance, but it was not from the NDIS straight up. Like, the NDIS have actually been really good with me. I'm not sure if that's because I'm terrifying or not. I certainly know lots of people who have had trouble getting aids and equipment. Also, home modifications has been a huge issue for a lot of people, especially in children who outgrow wheelchairs quickly. And the types of things that I hear from people every day is that, you know, that they're being asked to provide more and more evidence to prove that they need something. And, you know, you shouldn't have to jump through a million hoops and pay more and more money to go and get a piece of equipment, especially if it's a small piece of equipment, you know. So you shouldn't have to get a $500 report to go and get a $100 shaver or something. That's ridiculous. The red tape, I think, has been the biggest thing for most of the people that I know.
Yeah, it's a cost. I think it's way more expensive than it should be. I mean, it's probably 10 times what it's originally, what you can originally find in, like, the markets.
And then you look at how much it costs when they go to AAT and they go to court and pay millions of dollars for lawyers and whatever to fight over some small piece of equipment and whatever. You think, gosh, if they had saved that money and put it back into the scheme, then, you know, maybe we would have fewer problems than we've had now.
We all have been through this headache, but, yeah, such is life. Thank you for sharing that, Samantha. On that line, share your insights on the level of choice and control You've experienced in selecting therapy options under the NDIS?
Oh, that's tricky. So therapy options for me, I'm really bad at looking after my body. So I'm, because I'm old, right? So I'm like 56, I'm pretty old. And so for a lot of people, yes, pretty old. So a lot of people who are older people who haven't had much therapy in the past, like are really bad at looking after our bodies, and then they just fall apart at the end. And so I think a lot of people with developmental disabilities, you know, who are younger, are a bit more engaged with physios, and, you know, they know a bit more about it and they're a bit more engaged with it. The other thing I think is that there's a lot of physios who don't really know much about muscular dystrophy unless you're engaged with someone who's an agency provider, you know. And the other type of therapy that that I use is like therapy for my brain, but that's not my primary disability. So I have ADHD, and the way that ADHD works is that in Western Australia you have to go to a private psychiatrist to get ADHD medication, and that's not covered by the NDIS. That's a medical thing. And so in the NDIS you have to prove that it's directly related to your disability, and I'm in the NDIS under muscular dystrophy as my primary disability. So I've never claimed anything for all of the expensive psych bills. And so it's tricky if, you know, if I went in under being mad and having ADHD and being autistic, then what would that look like if I'm trying to link being a wheelchair user and getting equipment? So it's been quite tricky because of the way the NDIS works. I think the choices for people, if you're in the country, like there just aren't any providers. So I'm trying at the moment to find a psychiatrist who's in near Newcastle, where I am now, and there's just nothing. There's online psychiatrists, which are $800 a pop. If you look at the reviews online, they all say they're dodgy and they just take your money and run. And the ones that aren't dodgy, all the ones in Newcastle are full up, and there's just nobody available. So yeah, I think it can be really tricky for people trying to navigate, you know, without being on this referral roundabout. And you can't get in through the public system unless you go through public health and whatever, you know, what that looks like under NDIS is another thing as well.
Well, I'm telling you, there's lots of gaps in the system, but you know, we need to advocate and continue advocating for the, you know, what we stand for pretty much. And recognizing our voices, having that choice of control when it comes to the NDIS. So Samantha, how do you think the NDIS could better support individuals in making choices related to behavior management and therapy?
Yeah, that's a really tricky one. So from what I hear, you know, one of the recommendations in the review is around behavior management and around registration and making sure that we have professionalisation in that area. I think it's difficult to say that we're going to help people to make choices relating to things that might not necessarily be there. So the waiting lists in regional Western Australia are huge. They're years long, or you don't have them at all. I noticed that there was a thin market. There's a bit of information that's gone up on the NDIS website called Research and Evaluation. When you look at it, there's a really bad IT report about using artificial intelligence. It's the worst report ever. There's another one which is on thin markets, and that's the term they use for whether there's enough providers in an area. But they didn't cover WA or Queensland, and I'm really interested to know why. You can talk about saying we're going to have, you know, block funding, or we're going to have professionalisation or whatever, but I'd really like to know where these services are going to come from. We've got big gaps in the number of people that we've got, the number of providers. I'd like to know that we've got enough people to do the job, as well as being able to do it well. That's a tricky, tricky thing.
Yeah, that's the most important thing, as long as they know how to do it well. So given the training, even by the people with the disability, you know, train them to, you know, be able to support them. It's what it's all about. I mean, anyway, Samantha, do you have any final thoughts you would like to share with our audience?
Oh gosh, yes, a lot. So there's a lot of information that people haven't gotten because the NDIS analysis for the review, the NDIS review analysis, is 1400 pages long. And so to read that is ridiculous. I've got a thought that I've had is that if you know anybody who's got a paid subscription of ChatGPT, my friend Mark showed me how to set this up where you can create a GPT and you can split up the 1400 page report. You load it all up. You can load up to 20 documents. So you split your PDF up, you load it all up, and then you can ask it any questions that you like about the NDIS review, and it will tell you the answer. So it's really, really handy to analyze all of that really complicated stuff. So I know a lot of disabled people are using that now to pull out this stuff. You know, what does that mean for me? And you can do it with any documents. You can load up, you know, 20 documents and have a chat with this thing and work out how to do it. And see, Jonathan's eyes are lighting up here, tech head guy. So there's been a lot of people who have done some really sophisticated analysis around the NDIS review. And for those people, I'd also encourage you to look at the changes to the Aged Care Act that are happening right now. They're very aligned, especially around the area of safeguarding, where the pricing is coming from, a lot of things which are of concern. The biggest concern for me is that we're creating two tiers of disabled people, and we've got some people who are not necessarily going to be getting the same supports that they might have got before, or in the future, they might be getting a bit of gardening or housekeeping, something like HAC. I'm concerned that we don't have the supports, the foundational supports that they're talking about, because the states don't have them anymore. So that's my biggest concern.
So about that, it's been an honor to have you on the show. We always welcome you to come back and talk more about the NDIS as time goes by. Hopefully, it'll get better in the future. But it's something, yeah, we as people just really need to advocate for and work on to help improve the system. Thank you very much, Martha, for joining us once again.
Thank you so much. And it's great to see you guys again.
Yeah.
Take care. See you. Shout out to Stephanie as well.
Always a pleasure. You be on your group chat, your weekly podcast, everything civilly. Like a chair. See you, everyone.
Okay. See ya. Bye.